Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, when Donald Trump ran for president the second time, he promised he would be the peace president. No new wars was his pledge. Yet since returning to the Oval Office, Trump has ordered U.S. military force in multiple countries, including major strikes in Iran, Yemen, Syria, Somalia, and Nigeria, plus a direct military operation in Venezuela. And there are signs that Cuba could be next. Frontline PBS investigates Trump's war cabinet. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When Donald Trump was running for president in 2024, he promised that he would not start any new wars and that he would be the peace president. And he said that he would be able to stop the Russia-Ukraine war on his first day in office. Well, that war is still underway, and today the United States is 12 weeks into a hot war with Iran. Trump ordered the snatching of Venezuela's leader Nicolas Maduro, and there are signs that Trump has his sights next on Cuba. So what happened to those promises of peace, and who are Trump's close advisors who are enabling this war path? Frontline PBS Tonight airs a new documentary, The War Cabinet. It airs tonight on KLRN at 9 p.m. And we're joined by Mike Weiser. He is a writer, producer for Frontline. And Mike, welcome back to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So Trump ran saying he was going to be the peace president. He said that the world was teetering on the edge of World War III caused by Joe Biden. And he was going to bring us back from the brink. Then he gets elected. And we see one of his choices is for the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. And Pete Hegseth is clearly a hawk. And so he is in favor of not just war, but he seems to be, well, you know, he's jokingly called by some in the military as the Secretary of War Crimes. He is an aggressive person who wants to really enforce, have a great military might and use it. So did that give away the game that Donald Trump really wasn't interested in being the peace president when he selected Pete Hegseth?
Well, as you say, he had run on this campaign promise of not starting new wars. And it hadn't been just something that he'd run on in this last election cycle. It was something that he was running on when he first entered into politics back before 2016, running against the idea of endless wars, of the Iraq War, which he said was a dumb war. And it was very much part of his appeal. And in this film, what we found was that it was those choices of people like Pete Hegseth to be the Secretary of Defense that really made a difference this time around in the way that his first year would play out. And what we saw over the year was an increasing sequence of military actions that, of course, culminated in the attack and the war on Iran. And you're right to signal out Pete Hegseth as an important part of that. And it's not just the views that Hegseth came in with about how to use military power. It's the fact that Hegseth and the other people who Trump chose to be in his war cabinet, to be his advisors on foreign policy and these issues, were people who saw their job not as constraining the president, not as pushing back against him, but as enabling what it is that he wanted to do. They saw themselves as working for him and in many ways acted as an accelerant on things that the president wanted to do.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Are you disappointed that Donald Trump has stepped away from his plan to be a peace president, and he has launched all these military actions, including going to war with Iran. Do you find that to be something that will impact your future support for Donald Trump? Give us a call, 833-877-8255. So Tulsi Gabbard, the intelligence chief in the Trump administration, she was also somebody who had pretty much made her bones as a Democrat and then as a Republican, someone who did not want to go to war, and she fought in Iraq, and she was definitely somebody who supported Donald Trump's plan to be a peace president. But now she last week resigned. She will be leaving office at the end of June. Publicly, she said it's because of her husband's aggressive bone cancer. Other people are saying it also has something to do with how she has fallen out with Donald Trump, mainly because of her assessment that Iran did not have, was not nearing nuclear capabilities. Can you talk about that?
I think the role that Tulsi Gabbard played in the administration was critical, even though she was kept out of a lot of the key decisions as the year went on. And the reason why she was critical was that she was one of the few figures inside the administration who was seen as speaking out of turn. And as you referenced, that was in the run-up to the first attack on Iran last year, when the president ordered strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities. In the run-up to that, Tulsi Gabbard had delivered testimony questioning whether the Iranians had an active nuclear weapons program. She had sent out other messages on social media that seemed to suggest that she wasn't as hawkish as some of her colleagues. And when the president was asked about what it was that Tulsi Gabbard had testified before Congress, he said she's wrong. And after that point, she was very much seen by people inside Washington as being on the outer circle, being pushed out. There was a joke inside the White House, we were told, that the initials for her job, the DNI, the Director for National Intelligence, came to mean do not invite. And when you saw crucial actions like the attempt, like the successful seizing of Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, she was conspicuously absent, not in the room for those decisions. And so she was very much seen in Washington as somebody who had not delivered a consistent message with the president and had been pushed out. And the reason I think that's so important is that message that was received by others inside the Trump administration, people like J.D. Vance, who was also a war skeptic, but would have seen what happened to Tulsi Gabbard and would have understood that in this administration, you just can't deviate in the message that you're going to deliver. You have to stand with the president.
Well, there's some reporting today that J.D. Vance is finding himself not invited to some of these discussions about war now.
Yeah, I don't know about those reports, but I can tell you that Vance has had an incredible journey inside this administration. The first scene that we start the film with is the one where J.D. Vance is confronting Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. And it's only a few weeks into the administration, and Vance really seems to be ascendant inside the administration. He was somebody whose political rise was very much fueled on a feeling that the Iraq War had been a mistake. Vance himself, a veteran, talked about how it was a mistake, linked that to the war in Ukraine, and was very skeptical about American involvement in Ukraine, American involvement in the Middle East. And it really did seem at the beginning of the administration that Vance was on top. But what we saw as the year played out was that the more hawkish Marco Rubio was often the one standing behind the president and who seemed more aligned on some of these more aggressive steps, like the seizing of the leader of Venezuela. And so Vance now finds himself in a difficult place where he knows many of his political allies are very skeptical of the moves the president has taken in Iran in starting this war. And he's thinking about his political future. And he also knows he's in an administration where loyalty is valued above all else.
We're taking a break here. We're going to continue our discussion about Frontline. PBS's new documentary, The War Cabinet, airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KLRN PBS. It's also available on PBS.org Frontline on the PBS app, and you can find it at the PBS Documentaries on Prime Video. The Source continues after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Mike Weiser. He is a writer and a producer for Frontline PBS. Tonight, the new documentary airs, The War Cabinet, talking about President Donald Trump's actions, military actions around the world, with Iran, Venezuela, what's going to happen next in Cuba, of course, Syria, all sorts of other places, Nigeria. He's been active around the world. Strange for a man who ran on the platform of being a peace president. So Mike, back to Pete Hegseth. We had Signalgate, a journalist, prominent journalist, respected journalist, was invited accidentally into a private Signal chat where Pete Hegseth was giving away information about his war plans. What happened? What did we learn from that?
There was two parts about Signalgate, and one of them was that controversy that you're talking about was important information that related to an ongoing military operation. How did that end up going to a reporter? Why were they sending messages over a commercial chat program? But one of the other interesting things about Signalgate was that it's one of the few places where you really see and get insight into the key players inside the administration and the fact that they aren't all on the same page. When those Signalgate messages came out, one of the things that stood out was that J.D. Vance was expressing skepticism about these strikes. They were discussing whether to hit a Houthi group that was threatening shipping in the Middle East. And J.D. Vance, very much consistent with the politics that he had espoused as he was running for Senate and as vice president, was skeptical about U.S. involvement. And you sort of see a debate inside this Signalgate chat. And then one of the things that's even more remarkable is Stephen Miller, who's a deputy chief of staff, not on paper the most senior person on that chat, weighs in and says, essentially, I think the president has made a decision. And that's pretty much the last message that's sent before the operation begins and before the U.S. begins bombing. And so it reveals Vance's internal skepticism about some of these things, very much consistent with what we know about him. And it also reveals Stephen Miller, somebody who a lot of people thought wasn't even involved in foreign policy, weighing in almost as the president's enforcer in these discussions and being a key figure right before military action begins.
Why is it reckless, careless, irresponsible for the Secretary of Defense and others to be having this conversation on a commercial messaging app?
Well, we interviewed Jeffrey Goldberg, who was the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, who received those messages, and he was completely flabbergasted. In fact, he said that when he first received them, he thought it was some kind of misinformation operation, because how could the highest levels of the American government discussing a potential strike accidentally include a journalist? He was sort of in shock and unsure himself what to do with this information. He said that it was only when the strikes actually happened that he was convinced that these messages were real. And he said, as a national security reporter for his entire life, that he'd never seen anything like this, that operational details being spread in this way. You know, he was a reporter, but he told us he just as easily, you know, could have not been. And the fact that it was on a commercial messaging program meant that if the phones of the individuals involved were compromised, that foreign agents could have had access to these messages. So he definitely, as the person receiving it, saw it as a very reckless.
Here we are 12 weeks into the war with Iran. It is a war. And we're trying to figure out how we got here, because it does seem like Donald Trump was unprepared for the shutting down of the Strait of Hormuz and the consequences of that for petroleum supply throughout the world, also helium and fertilizer and all other things that would go through that, and this disruption to the global economy, and thinking that they would be able to do regime change. It seemed everything that Donald Trump said he thought he was going to be able to do by going to war with Iran did not happen. So did he just have bad advice from this war cabinet? How did we get here?
I think that's one of the questions that the film tries to answer, is how did we get here? And as we spoke to people about the run-up to the Iran war, we were told that the president was briefed on many of these things, like closing the Strait of Hormuz. J.D. Vance warned him of another aspect, which you didn't mention, which is the potential political blowback. So he was briefed on the potential dangers, but no one inside the administration was willing to say, you can't do this, or was willing to say, you know, if you do this, I'm going to walk away. And in fact, Vance, we were told, basically said, you know, I'm not in favor of this, but if you do it, I'll support you all the way. He saw that as his job. But I think the other answer to that question is that you have to look at this whole year, where when the president launched strikes on the Iranian nuclear program a year before, he had been warned by many people that this could lead to a much broader conflict, that there was a chance of plunging the United States into a prolonged war, that there would be all sorts of negative repercussions for it. And when he authorized the strikes and that didn't happen, people told us that it emboldened him. The strike on Venezuela to seize Nicolas Maduro was an incredibly risky operation where a plane could have gone down, Americans could have been killed, but that isn't what happened. And again, we were told that the president was very much emboldened. And so when he was warned about what could go wrong in Iran, he said in public, in fact, that he wasn't too concerned. He had been extraordinarily lucky up to that point. He'd been lucky in foreign policy. He'd in many ways been lucky in his political career, surviving scandals, impeachments, indictments, and returning to the presidency. And so he seemed to be supremely confident that despite the warnings, things would work out the way that he wanted them to.
So do not invite Tulsi Gabbard. Had said that Iran was not moving towards the development of a nuclear weapon. The conventional intelligence said that uranium was buried and cannot be accessed. Yet Trump continues to say that they were weeks away from developing a nuclear weapon. So did Trump have more faith in Israel's intelligence and what Netanyahu was telling him than what Gabbard was telling him?
Obviously, the nuclear program was part of it. But what we found as we went back and looked over those weeks and report in the film is that the pitch that Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, was making to Donald Trump about the reason to initiate this war was not just about the nuclear program. The pitch was very much that Donald Trump could have a legacy by finally dealing with the Iranian threat, that after 47 years of other presidents failing to stop this threat, that Donald Trump could be the one that history books would write about. And that's something that very much appealed to Donald Trump at that point in his presidency. In his second term, he's very much thinking about legacy. You can see it in the buildings and monuments he's trying to build in Washington. He's a president that's trying to leave a legacy. And so when Benjamin Netanyahu told him, here's a chance for you to be a historic figure, here's a chance for you to build a legacy, for you to do something that no other president could do, that was very appealing to Donald Trump.
In Trump's first term, his cabinet, it was not a war cabinet. These were people who were interested in giving him guardrails, not loyalty. So is that the difference now that we're seeing these developments shaping the world because he has a cabinet that is not willing to curb his impulses?
Absolutely. I think you've hit on a really key point, which was in his first term, there was this phrase, the adults in the room. And the idea was that the people who were around the president, who at that point was inexperienced in both Washington and in foreign policy, he'd been a reality TV star, he'd been a real estate developer, but he hadn't had experience in foreign policy. And many of them saw their job as containing him, as preventing the worst from happening. Fiona Hill, who served in his National Security Council during that first term, told us that she saw their job almost as somebody working at Chernobyl, trying to sort of contain the worst possibilities of what might happen. Others, including John Bolton, told us that they thought that they were serving the president when they were pushing back against ideas that they thought were dangerous. But there were others inside the administration who told us that what they saw was those figures as sabotaging the president, as contradicting the democratically elected leader of the country. And so as Trump came into this term, it was very clear from everyone around him that they were not going to make the mistake in their mind, as they described it, of the first term, of having people who saw themselves as the adults in the room, and that anyone who was going to sign up for this administration, whether they had vast experience like Marco Rubio or very little like Pete Hegseth, would have to understand that at the end of the day, the president was in charge and they were not there to contain them. They were not there to be the adults in the room.
So let Trump be Trump. Even Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, who is supposed to be so sharp, so disciplined, she is going to allow this to happen, not try to control it?
That's right. Susie Wiles is really one of the reporters who's covered her, told us, one of the most fascinating figures in politics. And she has survived inside Trump world for many years. Well, as you know, a lot of others have cycled through. And part of the way that she's done that is to draw on her personal experience in her own life, where she feels that her job with Trump is not to necessarily push back against him, but to manage him, to do what she can do. We're told that she, for example, did encourage him to be briefed on the potential dangers of attacking Iran and starting a war. But at the same time, she's not going to be like other chiefs of staff who might come into the president and give them hard truths and basically say, you're wrong. She doesn't see that as her job. She sees her job as managing the president, as doing what she can, but at the end of the day, respecting whatever it is the president decides.
Well, he decides based on his gut feeling, his gut instinct, not on intelligence. When you ostracize your intelligence chief, Tulsi Gabbard. So what do you want viewers to understand about how the Oval Office works, particularly when we launch missiles?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, as you build up this administration around him that sees their job as very much enabling the president, then your attention turns to how is the president making decisions? What is it that's driving him? And one of the people we spoke to was David Sanger, who's a New York Times reporter who interviewed Donald Trump along with a number of his colleagues in the White House. And at the time, Donald Trump was talking about wanting to take over Greenland. And he pushed him on this point and said to him, why do you want to take over Greenland? You've got a treaty that allows you to put the military, as much of the American military as you want into Greenland. And he said, I need it psychologically. And one of the other reporters in the room asked him, you need it psychologically for the country or you need it personally? And he said, I need it personally. And a lot of the Trump watchers that we spoke to felt like this was an essential part of understanding Donald Trump and the decisions that he's making, that he very much is making those decisions, as I said, with an eye towards legacy, with an eye towards how they will reflect on him, about whether they will project power for himself and for the United States. And so with the advisors around him, while they're so important, it's important to understand Trump and figure out what is driving him.
Mike Weiser, he is the writer, producer for Frontline. The War Cabinet airs tonight at 9 p.m. on KLRN PBS stations. It's also available on YouTube and on PBS Documentaries on Prime Video. That's The Source from Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.